The gospel reading comes to us this morning from Matthew's gospel, chapter 18, verses 21 through 35. Let us listen together to the gospel. Then Peter came and said to him, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, how often should I forgive? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, not seven times, but I tell you 77 times. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. When he began the reckoning, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. And as he could not pay, his lord ordered him to be sold, together with his wife and children, and all of his possessions, and payment to be made. So the slave fell on his knees before him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. But that same slave, as he went out, came upon one of his fellow slaves, who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him by the throat, he said, pay what you owe. Then his fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, have patience with me, and I will pay you. But he refused, and then he went and threw him into prison until he would pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. Then his lord summoned him and said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you? And in anger, his lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. So my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother or sister in your heart. May God bless the reading and hearing of this God's holy word. Like to dismiss the Sunday school. Like the desert needs the rain. It's 9/11, and of course it is 10 years to the day when those angry planes filled with jet fuel, loaded with passengers and a few who sought to weave fear into the world, that they flew into the Pentagon, into the World Trade Center towers, and into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Now, if you're like me, you remember that day like it was yesterday. I remember many of the details. I remember where I was when I heard the news. And I remember a lot of what I did that day. But you see, a lot of what I remember, maybe mostly what I remember, is that I felt helpless and powerless to do anything. I mean, I saw those images on my television, and I wondered, what can I do to all those poor souls at the World Trade Center towers? How could I comfort those who had lost loved ones and co-workers and station mates, and for those folks who were covered in white ash? I wondered, what could I do about any of it? Now, in the days and weeks that followed, I continued to feel powerless and helpless. I remember on September 17th, you remember the first day the stock market opened, I wondered how I could keep the stock market from falling 684 points again like it did that day. I wondered how I could help the world mobilize for peace and not mobilize for war. I wondered how I could help those around me to get rid of the urge for revenge that they felt and that I felt, and to work instead to get an urge for bridgehood and for making relationships even with those who are very different than us. I remember asking all of those questions. I remember feeling all of those things. But it's been 10 years now. And I have to admit that many of those same questions linger for me. I still feel overwhelmed and helpless and powerless in so many different ways. I'm still asking all of those same questions. I'm still wondering how to help create a world in which planes don't fly into buildings anymore and where folks don't feel the need to terrorize one another. Well, because so many of these questions still remain to be asked and to be answered, because it's been 10 years since 9/11 2001, and because there doesn't seem to be any less violence than there was a decade ago, it's this morning, especially this morning, that we need the gospel like the desert needs the rain. Helpfully, we have a gospel passage this morning that just happened to come up in the lectionary. Just happens to be the one scheduled for today. And it is a parable about forgiveness. Really a story about forgiveness. And I'm happy that we have it because it's one that speaks to us in concrete ways. For those of us who still feel helpless and still feel overwhelmed. It speaks to all of those of us who wonder what we can do to make the world a different sort of place. And it speaks to all of us who want to make the world into the image that God imagines it could be, has been, and could be again. So the passage itself begins in verse 21, and Peter, Jesus' disciple, comes to Jesus and asks him, "How many times should I forgive a brother or sister who has sinned against me? 7 times? Which is a generous number. Actually, the number 7 means perfect. Should I forgive perfectly, generously? Think about it. Say someone steals money from you. How many times will you forgive? 1, 2, 3, 4 times? But 7 times is a generous number. But even though that's a generous number, Jesus pushes him even further. He says, don't forgive generously. Don't forgive 7 times, but forgive 77 times. Or the Greek is unclear here. It could even mean 70 times 7, or 490. Whether it's 77 or 490, the message itself is clear that Jesus says, don't only forgive generously, but give unfailingly, incalculably, and without accounting. Don't even have to think about it. Just forgive is his answer to Peter. Parenthetical note here about what this passage is not saying. This passage has been used by pastors and churches and people to enable abuse. To say, just forgive your abuser. Just forgive that person. You know, just go back to them. Just offer forgiveness. Which puts the abused in a position to be abused again. And this passage is not about enabling abuse. It's about Jesus helping us to understand the radical nature of the world that God imagines for us. And he says, give without fail, without accounting, incalculably. It's not about enabling abuse. It's not about forgetting necessarily, but it is about forgiving. I think that's an important point to keep in mind as we think about this parable. So, anyway, as the parable continues, Jesus moves from the question of how many times to forgive to the question of why we should forgive without accounting. And he tells the parable what is sometimes called the parable of the unmerciful servant. Now, as it starts, Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servant or his slave. Sort of a funny way of starting that. And before we get too much further into it, I want to take just a second to think about this phrase, the kingdom of heaven, because it's really important. For those of you who have studied the Gospel of Matthew, you'll know that Matthew uses this phrase, the kingdom of heaven, a lot. He uses it 50 different times. And he uses it 10 different times to give us an analogy of what the kingdom of heaven is like. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. It's like yeast rolled into a ball of dough. It's like a net cast into the sea. And in our passage, it is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servant. What's interesting is that in every single instance that Jesus makes this analogy, he makes the analogy about everyday, ordinary things. Keep that in mind. The question becomes, right at the beginning, of what is the kingdom of heaven exactly? Like, what does Matthew mean by the kingdom of heaven? And so scholars debate this endlessly and get much tenure and promotion out of this, but just sort of in a brief summary of what does the kingdom of heaven mean, I'll just give you my summary. The kingdom of heaven in Matthew's gospel is the reign of God, which is breaking forth through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, which destroys sin, reconciles relationships, and puts the world back together. So what is the kingdom of heaven? The kingdom of heaven is the reign of God that's come into the world through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, that destroys sin and reconciles relationships and puts the world back together again. It's an important concept. It's a huge concept. I mean, we can say it, but we can't understand it. It doesn't quite fit all up here. So that's why Jesus says in 10 different ways, the kingdom of heaven is like this, the kingdom of heaven is like that, the kingdom of heaven is like that. Because we can't fit it all in here, so he gives us a glimpse here and there of what it might be like. And so in our parable, we get one slice of what the kingdom of heaven is like, and he says the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wants to settle accounts with his servants. Parable continues like this. King wants to settle his account, so he finds one person who owes him 10,000 talents, which is a way of saying all the money in the world. It is an astronomical number. And that servant would never be able to pay that amount of money back, not even in 1,000 lifetimes. So he comes to the king, and the king says, I'm going to sell you all into slavery and all of your possessions because at least I can get some of my money back. And of course, the servant is distraught and upset, and he says, oh, please be patient with me. The king does. The king is patient, and he forgives the debt completely. He's scot-free. He doesn't have to pay back this astronomical sum anymore. He is freed and he is liberated. But see, then he goes off, and quickly he comes across a servant who owes him money. 100 denarii. A denarii is like a day's wages. So 100 days' wages. So it's not a small sum, but it's not an astronomical sum either. And so this unmerciful servant is approached by this other servant who owes him money, and rather than forgiving as he has been forgiven, what does he do? He yells at him and he chokes him, and then he throws him into prison. It's outrageous, right? He's just been forgiven this astronomical sum, and now he won't even forgive a modest sum. And this is where things heat up, right? Because the king finds out about this. And the king calls to the unmerciful servant, and he yells at him, and then he throws him into prison until he can pay back his debt, which is to say he throws him into prison forever. King is really mad. It's really important for the king and for Jesus here to forgive as we have been forgiven. And Jesus even hammers the point home with this really pointed and harsh language at the end here when he says that this too will happen to you. Unless you forgive as you have been forgiven, which is unfailingly, incalculably, and without accounting, you will be in prison forever. It's a strong statement. So what is the kingdom of heaven like from this parable? The kingdom of heaven, this reign of God breaking forth into the world, is like forgiving as we have been forgiven. And why do we forgive as we have been forgiven? We forgive because when we do, we make the world a better place. We avoid putting ourselves in prisons of our own making, and we help to weave the world back together again. Forgiving as we have been forgiven is really important. It's so important that it's what the kingdom of heaven is like. So hold that. But I want to take us to a larger principle that we can extract from this parable about forgiveness. Because there's more going on here than just a message about forgiving as we have been forgiven. As important as that message is, there's a bigger one here. And here's what I think it is. I went back and I read all of the parables where the kingdom of heaven is likened to something. And without fail, as I alluded to earlier, every single one of the things that Jesus mentions that the kingdom of heaven is like are ordinary, everyday things. There are 10 different passages, and I'll just list to you what they are. Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed, a mustard seed, yeast mixed into flour, treasure hidden in the field, a merchant looking for pearls, a net let down into the lake, the owner of a house, a king who settles accounts, a landowner who hires workers, and a king who prepares a wedding banquet for his son. And notice how ordinary those things are. Notice how understandable those things are. Notice how the kingdom of heaven isn't described in these geopolitical terms, these unusual terms, these exotic terms, these abstract terms. Jesus explains what the kingdom of heaven is like in terms of things we all know and we all can understand and that we can all touch in the ordinary events of our everyday lives. You see, we might expect the kingdom of heaven to be described to us like it's a solar eclipse or a utopian island or a mountain of gold, but it's not. It's described to us in terms of bookkeeping, in terms of farming and fishing and seeds. This is no small point for us this morning, especially this morning as we remember 9/11. This is no small point for us that it is explained to us in these ordinary terms. It's no small point for us today as we consider how we are to live with our lives, wondering how we, ordinary, average, everyday folks, are supposed to stand against global terrorism, supposed to stand against the global war machine bent on destruction, supposed to stand against the power of global markets and complex global forces that we don't understand. What can we do? And what can we do in this small little country church to make an impact on anything at all? I mean, is our harvest market a match for Wall Street? Maybe, didn't it? Is our fledgling community dinner series that just started on Thursday, is that an antidote for terrorism, perhaps? It may sound naive this morning, but that's okay, because I also think it's biblical, and I also think it's gospel. Gospel that we need today like the desert needs the rain. So I'll just say it anyway. Naive to your ears or not. But what Jesus is doing in his parables, what he's trying to communicate to us is that in the end, the kingdom of heaven becomes real in the world, not through governments and not through global markets and not through central banks and not through armies. You see, Jesus is trying to communicate to us that the kingdom of heaven becomes real in the world first in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, but then we come. It becomes real in the world through the everyday actions of our ordinary lives. Simple actions. Like when we're generous to our neighbors. Like when we go help flood victims in the next town over, like when we manage our businesses ethically, like when we forgive as we have been forgiven. You see, it's not out there, but right here. It's not in legislation, but it's right here. It's not in initial public offerings, it's right here. It's not in armies. Right here. The kingdom of heaven begins at home. And the kingdom of heaven begins at home, and the kingdom of heaven begins at home. So here we are. Beautiful sunny day. We're in this small little rural country church, and here we are talking about forgiveness and about parables and about the kingdom of heaven. And yet there's violence and more violence out there. And terrorism and more terrorism and more war. And there may be some sitting here this morning thinking that these parables and this kingdom talk, it sounds nice, but that in the end it's meaningless. It may sound to some here this morning like we're bringing a knife to a gunfight and a prayer to a fire squad. Maybe it sounds like that, but I'll tell you, from the very beginning, from the moment that Jesus hung on the cross, the gospel has always been accused of being powerless and meaningless and even opium for the masses. Even Jesus' most ardent supporters thought that his death meant defeat and that the the powerful have won. But you see, Barbara Brown Taylor, writer and pastor and preacher, reminds us, doubting ones, me included, disillusioned ones, us fearful ones, that God doesn't work like we do, that God doesn't think like we do, that God doesn't do things that we expect, and that even in the face of great power and wealth and forces bigger than we are, that in the end, well, the gospel is bigger still. She says this. Take the sunroom at the nursing home, where you stand by the piano surrounded by wheelchairs full of old people, some of them dozing, some of them whimpering to go back to their room. Less than half of them even aware that you are there, and say resurrection in their presence. Say life everlasting, say remember. Just let those words loose in the room, just utter them in the light and trust them to do their work. Or speak to a support group for people with AIDS. Worship with them if you can, and lay your hands on their hands and pray for their healing. Say mercy to them. Say comfort. Say, beloved children of God, just let those words loose in the room. Just utter them and trust in their power to make people whole. Or let something you care about lead you to the steps of City Hall, where you stand staring into television, wondering what in the world you've gotten yourself into, and just say justice. Say peace. Say the righteousness of God, and never mind what other people say. Never mind that they walk past you without reading your sign or put you in the back of the paddy wagon and take you away. That God is in charge of the result. See, Brown Taylor, in her eloquent way, reminds us of the power and the relevancy of gospel. She reminds us that as bad as the world seems, that all is not lost. And that even now God is empowering us, me and you, through the ordinary actions of our everyday lives, to make the kingdom of heaven real in such a way that planes don't fly into buildings anymore. And terrorist is a word we've all forgotten. So this morning, especially this one, we need the gospel, I think, like the desert needs the rain. Thanks be to God for the gospel. Thanks be to God that we can proclaim it on 9/11 and every other day. In our actions and with words like, no more war, no more flood, no more death, no more suffering. Just say those words. Let them float into the room. Trust that God will make the kingdom possible.